everything, from the middle of his back to his tailbone to his toes, was in fiery pain. His ankles always ached, but now every step he took was answered by a sharp crackle in his knees, too. The constant, jagged, sawing sensation in his right hip had worsened to the point that he now let out a little gasp every time it flared. All that was aside from the deep, burning gash in his hand. He'd seen a flash of white bone when he sustained the injury the day before. There hadn't even been time to bind the wound properly, much less sew it shut. Still, there were worse things than a gashed palm. He wasn't running because he wanted to. He was running because otherwise he would already be dead. Up, down, and now up again, high into the mountains. It was a trip he'd taken many times, but never with this level of urgency. He was used to the climb, knew how to step around the dangerous patches of scree and pace himself to avoid burning out his legs or losing his wind. But there was no time for that now. His pursuers were right behind him. He thought he had managed to lose them in the pine forests just below the tree line. He'd even stopped to chomp on a bit of smoked meat to replenish himself, but then he had seen them on the winding path a few switchbacks below him. There were few who were better on a fast climb than him, but these men were keeping up. Worse still, they had bows and arrows, and he didn't, at least not one that worked. The half-finished bow staff he carried wouldn't do him a lick of good. If they got close, he would use his copper axe, but they probably wouldn't give him the chance. In their shoes, he wouldn't. So, he ran. He would keep running until he crossed the mountains to the north. Maybe he could find somewhere to hide before then, in one of the lower meadows or on a goat trail that took him out of sight, but he doubted it. If they'd tracked him this far, they could keep tracking him. He sucked a breath of thin air into his lungs and took one more step forward, then another, as fast as his aching legs could carry him. When the arrow slammed into his left shoulder, he was still running, but they were the last steps he ever took. The impact of the arrow hurtled him forward, and he fell, his head smashing against a hard stone next to the path. He rolled a few times and then came to a stop, blood dripping onto the scree beneath him. Mercifully, unconsciousness had already swept him away from feeling when the killer stomped down hard onto his back. The man wanted his arrow back. Only the shaft came away, and the man cursed. It would take him hours to nap a new one. A shame. Leaving the dead man face down on the rock, the killer began his long journey back down the mountain. The body he left behind stayed there, high in the Alps, for the next 5,000 years. Hello, friends. Welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for joining me. On September 19th, 1991, two German tourists, Helmut and Erika Simon, were climbing in the Ötztal Alps. At 10,000 feet on the border between Austria and Italy, they found something completely unexpected. A corpse buried up to the waist in ice. They initially thought that it was the body of a deceased climber, some unfortunate who'd stumbled off a ridge or had gotten caught in a freak snowstorm. Wisely, they summoned local authorities to investigate. Using drills and ice axes, a team eventually managed to remove the body, which was then taken to a medical examiner in nearby Innsbruck, Austria, for analysis. A local archaeologist, however, quickly disabused everyone of the idea that this was the corpse of a recently deceased climber. The copper axe found with the remains, he explained, was at least 4,000 years old. The body was that of an ancient individual who died millennia ago, preserved in extraordinary condition by alpine snow and ice. We know him as Ötzi, a name derived from the Ötztal Alps where his body was discovered. Over the subsequent decades since his discovery and excavation from the ice, scholars have investigated every imaginable aspect of this ancient person's life. Now housed in his own special museum in Bolzano, surveys revealed that he had been discovered roughly 300 feet on the Italian side of the border, we have come to know Ötzi intimately. He's even older than initially thought, having lived between 3350 and 3100 BC in a time we know as the Chalcolithic, or Copper Age, meaning his remains were frozen into that glacier for more than 5,000 years. We've learned that Ötzi was genetically prone to heart disease and was probably balding. He had moved several times in his life, living mostly on the southern slopes of the Alps, and he had more than 60 tattoos marking his skin. There's a good argument to be made that we know more about Ötzi, at least in terms of his physical remains, than any other person from the past. Archaeologists have tested every new scientific technique on Ötzi, from isotope analysis to ancient genome studies. He is, in fact, the poster child for all that we can now hope to learn about the distant past. In today's episode, we'll explore Ötzi's incredible story and the many scientific and historic possibilities afforded by the techniques used to study him. How Ötzi lived, the final journey that brought him up into the Ötztal Alps, how he died, and what his life and death can tell us about the world Ötzi inhabited. No matter how far back we look, every single person who lived before the present was just as real, as much a three-dimensional flesh and blood person as Ötzi. The fact that we can only see that in rare, practically one-of-a-kind cases, such as this one, is a problem of preservation and evidence, not those past people themselves. But through Ötzi, we can see how much we've lost and how much we still have to learn. We do know precisely how Ötzi died. Someone shot him from behind with a stone-tipped arrow that struck him in the left shoulder with so much force that it broke his scapula, severed major blood vessels, and lodged near his lung. The wound was so severe that even if he'd been within minutes of a modern emergency room, it likely still would have been fatal. 5,000 years ago, at an elevation of more than 10,000 feet and dozens, if not hundreds of miles from any population center, Ötzi never had a chance. Who killed him and why are questions that we can never hope to answer. It's hard enough to solve a murder today, let alone one that took place millennia ago. But the how is clear enough. Some scholars have made the argument that Ötzi died elsewhere and some other group brought his body up the Tisanyok Pass for deposition. Personally, I don't find that argument convincing, nor do most people who study Ötzi. It's far more likely that Ötzi died within feet of the place his body was eventually found, lying face down, arms akimbo, for thousands of years before the climbers made their ascent on that September day in 1991. While Ötzi's luck ran out the day he died, ours had just begun. Now, when we think of mummies, we typically think of ancient Egypt, where for thousands of years people practiced a specific form of intentional mummification. Before they did so intentionally, the heat and aridity of their desert surroundings did much the same thing, naturally. The earliest Egyptian mummies, like the individual we know as Gebelein Man, who lived at the same time as Ötzi, were natural mummies, though experiments had begun even by that time. But in this respect, Egypt is not unique. There are numerous places and regions around the world with similar conditions that, under the right circumstances, can mummify remains without human intervention. The Tarim Basin in Central Asia has produced millennia of mummified remains. In the Atacama Desert of Chile, inhabitants realized much the same thing the Egyptians did, moving away from allowing their arid surroundings to naturally mummify the bodies of the dead to taking on the task themselves. It's less often realized, however, that cold and ice can do the same thing as aridity and extreme heat. The Andes Mountains are full of individuals who were deposited at high altitudes as human sacrifices. In the Scythian burial chambers carved into the Siberian permafrost, multiple examples of mummified remains have been discovered. Several of the crew of the Franklin expedition, lost in the Arctic in the 1840s, were almost perfectly preserved when their graves were discovered in the 20th century. All of this means that while Ötzi is extraordinary in the extent of scholarly attention his remains have received, the basic fact of their icy preservation is not. Even so, by the standards of mummified human remains, the level of Ötzi's preservation is incredible. His skin, his blood vessels, and even his stomach contents survived thousands of years in the ice. When we combine that degree of preservation with the application of every imaginable scientific test, the results tell us more than we could ever hope to know about Ötzi's life before his ascent to the Tisanyok Pass. Ötzi was somewhere between 35 and 50 when he died, likely closer to the upper end of that estimate than the lower, and every one of those years had been hard. Ötzi was quite short by today's standards, standing about 5'3" tall, but he was wiry and strong, weighing around 135 pounds when he died. His legs were particularly well-conditioned, with highly developed muscle attachments and thick bones. He was accustomed to long hikes and climbs in the Alpine foothills long before his final trip into the high passes. Those journeys left their marks on him. Ötzi had mild arthritis in his knees and more severe degeneration in his right hip, and we can imagine him stretching his sore legs, massaging aching joints, and dreading the onset of damp weather that would have worsened his conditions. If he were carrying heavy loads while traveling, which seems likely based on the wear and tear in his lumbar and cervical spine, those pains would have been more severe. There were no wheeled vehicles or draft animals in Utsi's world, and in any case, the terrain he lived in wasn't conducive to anything other than pack animals and human porters. At some point, Utsi suffered a bout of frostbite, which damaged the little toe of his left foot. Maybe his boots got wet crossing a stream, or he was caught in an unseasonal blizzard on one of his trips through the mountains. He had suffered 4 broken ribs on his left side, probably the result of a single accident. We have no idea what caused this injury. It was the only time Utsi fractured bones before he died. Utsi's skin tells a fascinating story. It took a few years and advanced tests for researchers to find them, and still more to make sense of them. But we now know that Utsi had 61 distinct tattoos in 19 separate groupings, everywhere from his lower legs to his lower back to his wrist and chest. Most of them take the form of lines and crosses rather than anything figurative. These markings seem to correlate with places where Utsi had underlying pathologies, the degenerative conditions brought on by age and activity, and some observers have classified them as therapeutic tattoos, similar in concept to acupuncture. At first, these findings were surprising. An ancient mummy with tattoos? But subsequent work on other mummified human remains has found that tattooing was, in fact, extremely common worldwide. Where skin has been preserved well enough for us to examine it under special forms of light, the evidence is right there for us to see. Images of Barbary sheep, baboons, crosses, and hieroglyphs in ancient Egypt. Geometric patterns and animals on Andean mummies. And extraordinary animal designs on the Scythians buried in the Siberian permafrost. In this regard, Utsi is quite typical of other ancient humans. A joint team of archaeologists and artists recently experimented on human subjects with various methods to recreate the precise tattooing procedures used on Utsi. They found that the lines and crosses were hand-poked with a sharp tool carrying pigment on the tip, a technique still used by traditional tattoo artists around the world today. Just as a brief aside, ancient tattooing is a new and incredibly exciting area of research, and it's quite accessible to interested laypeople. You can check out the lead author of that Utsi paper, Aaron Dieter Wolf, on Instagram at Archaeology Inc., and one of the participants slash authors, Danny Rade, at Totemic Tattoo. Then, as now, the skin served as a medium for delivering various messages about identity, statements of belief and belonging. We don't know what those were in Utsi's case, and perhaps the therapeutic explanation is correct, but it is mind-boggling to consider that there was a whole visual language of body decoration throughout the human past that we were barely aware of until recently. In this regard, as in so many others, Utsi sheds light on the world far beyond himself. We know where Utsi died, 10,000 feet up in the Tisanyok Pass, but do we know where he lived? Can we reconstruct his life, his journeys, and their itineraries, and glimpse the same sights he saw as he traipsed around the foothills of the Alps? Thanks to the miracles of isotope analysis, we can do all of these things and more. Scientists have been able to pinpoint Utsi's home, or homes more accurately, with incredible precision. The ratios of strontium and oxygen isotopes in Utsi's teeth, the values of which are locked in childhood when bone finishes growing, point to a youth spent in one of several high alpine valleys not far from the Tisanyok Pass. The two best candidates for Utsi's home are the lower Valpusteria, about 70 miles east of where he died, and the Valle Isarco, roughly 40 miles east. The Valle Isarco even has a standing stone, a menhir, dating from this same period. It's fascinating to imagine Utsi seeing that monument in his own lifetime. The isotopic values in Utsi's cortical bones, which remodel themselves during adulthood, are different from those in his teeth. The differences tell us that he moved away from that high alpine valley after his childhood, though it's harder to say precisely where. There are a few places nearby that match the isotope ratios in the cortical bone, such as the location of the present town of Juvale, about 20 miles west of Utsi's place of death. But because those isotopic values are contradictory, another interpretation is that he moved around a great deal as an adult, traveling between places where the water contained different isotopic ratios. Scholars used to prefer this explanation, arguing that Utsi's activity levels and location pointed to him being a shepherd. For millennia, shepherds in this region of the Alps have moved their flocks between low winter pastures and summer pastures up in the mountains, a practice called transhumance. With limited information, it's hardly unreasonable to believe Ötzi did this as well. More recent research, however, argues against this idea. Environmental studies of the pollen in the areas around the mountain meadows Ötzi would have utilized show that they were not being used for that purpose until well into the Bronze Age, around 1500 BC, nearly 2,000 years after Ötzi lived. While it's possible he used other pastures or grazed his livestock in a way that left signs we haven't yet found, I think it's more likely Ötzi was doing something else with his time. For more precise information on Ötzi's lifestyle and occupation, we can turn from his physical remains to the items he was carrying at the time of his death. The same ice that preserved his skin, brain, digestive tract, and blood vessels also saved the unique array of items in his possession from being lost to time. His hide clothing, his wooden bow and arrow shafts, the handle of his copper axe, even his fire starting kit and the medicinal herbs and fungi he carried. Far too often, we're left with a few scattered bones and pieces of flaked stone. Here, we have preserved evidence of some of the organic materials that people in the distant past used on a daily basis. When we squeeze those items for information, they tell us a whole series of stories about who Ötzi was and what he was doing. When Ötzi made his final climb up the Tisanyok Pass, he was dressed for the occasion. He wore a sheepskin loincloth, goat leather leggings, a cloak made from goat and sheepskins, a belt of cowhide, leather shoes stuffed with grass, and an outer cloak woven from grass. A fur hat made from bearskin completed the ensemble. We don't tend to think of clothing as technology in the same way we do tools, but they're absolutely part of the same conversation. In Ötzi's case, we can see exactly how sophisticated and intelligent his sartorial choices were. The leather garments he wore had been tanned using a specific fat tanning process that made them water repellent, a necessity for anyone dealing with the rain and snow common in the Alps and their foothills. Packed grass provides wonderful insulation in cold temperatures, which explains their presence in his shoes. When woven, it is a waterproof miracle of natural engineering. Goatskin is soft and supple, which explains why Ötzi chose that material for his leggings. They were more comfortable on long, strenuous hikes and perhaps chafed less than the alternatives. These garments were made with intention, perfectly designed for a journey up into the mountains. They were not the clothes of a man who accidentally wandered into a blizzard. Ötzi also carried a backpack or pannier. The frame was made from a single 6-foot length of hazel wood that had been bent into a U shape while still fresh and pliable, with a pair of wooden boards spanning the U. Cords woven from grass held the frame together, and a fur sack for Ötzi's possessions was tied to it. He might have worn the contraption over his shoulders, or it could have been tied to his belt. A leather container, like a fanny pack, also hung from his belt. It housed two birch bark containers, one for storing live embers for making a fire, and one for carrying birch fungus, which has anti-parasitic properties. Analysis of his digestive tract tells us that Ötzi suffered from a raging whipworm infection, hence the birch fungus. A fire-starting kit with flint, pyrites, and mushroom pulp for tinder also went into the fanny pack. A short-bladed flint knife and a grass sheath hung from his belt. A quiver made from the hide of a red deer carried his arrow shafts, a bowstring, and animal sinew. I said before that Ötzi was carrying a bow at the time of his death, but that's not quite true. What he had was a 6-foot length of yew wood, a bow stab that he hadn't yet finished and strung. A majority of the arrows he carried were likewise mostly unfinished. The only two that were finished were both broken. The real centerpiece of Ötzi's collection was a fine copper axe. We call the era in which Ötzi lived the Chalcolithic, or Copper Age, precisely because this was the period when metalworking was being refined and proliferating, but before the secrets of bronze alloy had reached his part of the world. Ötzi's axe had a shaft of dense yew and a 3.5-inch blade set into it, bound with leather while the wood was still wet so that the shaft contracted around the metal blade as it dried. It's a brilliant piece of technology, and like practically everything Ötzi carried, it was worn and well used. I mentioned earlier that Ötzi was a highly mobile man, but based on the evidence we currently have, we can't say with certainty that he was a long-distance shepherd. The copper axe offers an alternative explanation for his mobility. Copper metallurgy was still a rare and precious technology in Ötzi's lifetime. And while there's plenty of copper in the Alps, that's not where the metal in his axe came from. The closest matches for the isotope values in his copper are found not in the Alps, but in metal from Tuscan mines some 300 miles away. If Ötzi was involved in the trading of copper ingots or finished copper items, that would explain his mobility and his access to an uncommon, high-status item like a copper axe. Additional support for this idea comes from Ötzi's lungs, of all places. Upon examination, they were found to be full of fine coal particles, the kind you would inhale while spending long periods of time sitting indoors around a fire. Ötzi's hair contained higher than expected levels of copper and arsenic, which is a common impurity in copper ore and was sometimes intentionally added to pure copper to create some of the earliest metal alloys. We lack other samples from Ötzi's Chalcolithic Society to which we could compare his levels of copper and arsenic exposure, but what we have is suggestive, at the very least. Given the information available to us now, this seems like a plausible explanation for Ötzi's lifestyle. When he set off into the Alps on that late spring or early summer day more than 5,000 years ago, it wasn't Ötzi's first mountain adventure, but it would be his last. We can reconstruct that final journey in extraordinary detail. The copper axe was a high-status item, but that doesn't mean Ötzi's life was easy or free from conflict. In fact, the weeks leading up to his death had been especially difficult. We know this from Ötzi's fingernails, which show what are called Beaufort lines. These lines tell us that at roughly 8, 12, and 16 weeks before his death, Ötzi had experienced episodes of nutritional stress. He either went hungry or ate extremely poor quality food during these periods, which interfered with the normal growth of his fingernails. He was eating well in the days before his death, however, which we know because the contents of his stomach and digestive tract are still intact after all these millennia. He had consumed einkorn wheat, barley, ibex and red deer, and domesticated goat. His final meal, which hadn't even begun to be digested in his stomach, consisted of more ibex, smoked red deer meat, and a variety of domesticated grains. This was a fatty, energy-dense regimen suitable for someone doing intense physical activity in the mountains, and it's probably typical of what he ate when he had good access to food. Ötzi's arteries also show signs of hardening, a common consequence of habitually consuming a high-fat diet. We can go still further in our understanding of Ötzi's final days. Over the 33 hours prior to his death, the various pollens that hitched a ride in his digestive tract tell us that Ötzi went up to high altitude, down, and then up again for a final time. The day before his death, he'd been high up around the tree line, about 8,200 feet, where he ate his breakfast of einkorn and barley mush. After breakfast, he climbed a long way down, about 4,000 feet, into a valley of broadleaf forest. That was where he ate lunch, again, a meal of grain mush. He probably spent the rest of the day around that altitude. He may also have begun to climb again. The next morning, the day of his death, Ötzi stopped to eat his first meal of the day in a coniferous forest, about halfway between the broadleaf forest and the tree line. He ate his next and last meal well above the tree line, probably not far from where he died. We'll never know who killed Ötzi or why, but his rapid ascents and descents in the hours before his death plausibly speak to his being pursued by hostiles. The deep gash in his right hand, which he received no more than a couple of days before he died, supports this idea. While there are many ways to cut one's hand, especially for someone who was habitually handling sharp implements like axes and knives, the location of the hand injury is suggestive. It's precisely the kind of defensive wound someone suffers when they're trying to ward off a blow. The bruises on Ötzi's hands and wrists lend credence to this interpretation as well. Despite carrying a quiver, he didn't have a functioning bow. Only two of the arrows he was carrying were finished, while the rest were in various stages of preparation. It's possible that Ötzi had lost his bow and shot most of the arrows he was carrying with him, or only realized that he needed one after he began his journey. When we put these clues together, Ötzi's high-altitude demise makes more sense. Someone or some group of people was chasing him. He had successfully managed to evade his pursuers for several days, covering dozens of miles and thousands of feet in elevation, but eventually his luck ran out. One of those pursuers shot him in the back with an arrow. Ötzi fell face first, cracking his skull on a hard surface. Even if the arrow embedded in his shoulder hadn't killed him, the cerebral hemorrhage would have. As he lay face down on the mountain, someone, his killer, most likely, planted their foot on his back and tried to yank out the valuable stone arrowhead. Only the shaft came away, leaving the stone point embedded deep inside his flesh. Then the killer left Utsi behind, either already dead or bleeding out quickly. Before long, snow covered Utsi's body. Over centuries and millennia, the snow turned to ice. During warm periods, small parts of his body were exposed, but never enough to compromise the preservation of his remains. There, Utsi stayed for more than 5,000 years, until those two German hikers spotted him, half buried in the ice. We're lucky to have Utsi. We know so little about his Chalcolithic world in northern Italy, and here we find a fully fleshed out person, literally. Utsi is full of information about that lost time and place. From him, we have learned so much and stand to learn even more. About a single murder, of course, but also about the trade networks that connected Chalcolithic societies, linking places hundreds of miles from each other. About the movements of one person around a landscape that has long since disappeared. About how he and his people made tools and clothing, essential details that almost never survived thousands of years of decay. And most of all, about the experience of living, physically living, in the remote past. Utsi ate, and sometimes couldn't get enough to eat. He suffered from intestinal distress, the result of parasites and bacterial infections. He had aches from decades of wear and tear on his body, the consequences of the active life he was required to live. He sat repeatedly for tattoos, taking fine point needles to his flesh for pain relief, possibly, or simply decoration. He hacked and coughed from the particulates in his lungs. His teeth hurt, worn down by a lifetime of eating roughly ground grains. He felt more intense pain shortly before his death when his hand was sliced open. In the end, Utsi's body proved to be fragile and mortal, the arrow severing his life's thread as it cut through his subclavian artery. Every single person who lived in the distant past, whether their remains mummified or not, was just as real, as corporeally present as Utsi. Only rarely do we get the opportunity to understand what that truly means. In this new and exciting age of research, Utsi, now housed at the South Tyrol Museum of Archaeology in his native Italy, reveals the possibilities for understanding past humans as people, no different from us. Next time on Past Lives, we'll meet one of Utsi's rough and physically distant contemporaries. A young man who was stabbed in the back along the banks of the Nile and buried near the town of Gebelein, where his remains were found more than 5,000 years later. We know him now as Gebelein Man, and he lived at the dawn of history in ancient Egypt. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. It's only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content like Q&As, interviews with scholars, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule, and thanks so much. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. This has been Past Lives.